Welcome to another episode of Harvest Series, a podcast following a four-day experience in Kaplankaya on the southwestern Aegean coast of Turkey, filled with fascinating talks and workshops to harvest knowledge and nurture the planet, an event produced by Athena Advisors and Capital Partners.
That was a very kind of pretty boring suburb, and I learned very early on that if I was not going to get stuck in that kind of boorish wild way of thinking, living, I better get out. And so I learned very early to have only one word in my vocabulary, and that was yes, and to jump off cliffs. One thing I discovered in life is that no one wants you to change, and you have to follow your inner compass, and you have to understand that creativity is not the motivation of action, it's a consequence of action. If you don't do something, you can't create. People aren't born creative, which is a bourgeois fantasy, right? No, you have to make yourself creative.
I'm Rose, a French journalist based in Barcelona. In this special edition of Harvest in London, I bring you an interview conducted with the remarkable Wade Davis. As a National Geographic Explorer in Residence, Wade's journey has spanned from the lush Amazon and the heights of Tibet to the diverse landscapes of Africa, Australia, Polynesia, and the Arctic. Professor of Anthropology at the University of British Columbia, Wade is also a prolific author, known for his captivating works including The Serpent on the Rainbow, One River, and Magdalena River of Dreams. Wade was my inaugural guest in Kaplankaya for this podcast, and I'm thrilled to reconnect with him here for another insightful conversation. He will talk first about anthropology, and then we will discuss cancel culture, how to fight for your ideas, and what advice he would like to give to the next generation. Hello, Wade.
Hi, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again. Thank you for being with us. It's the second time because you were the very first episode of this podcast Harvest series. Yes. And we had discussed in the first episode about your favorite rituals, your wild years in Harvard, and also how you chose anthropology a bit by coincidence, saying yes to everything at the time, which was
That's
amazing.
Right. Very true.
So today, in a world where we're facing like many global challenges and we have to focus on the future, I will ask this question that sounds a little bit provocative, but it's not that much because it comes from you. Why do anthropology matters?
You know, it's very interesting. It's kind of a thought experiment. If you ask yourself to think about the world of your great-grandfather or grandmother and their values about race, their attitudes towards the environment, their notions of a kind of hierarchy of culture that invariably placed European society at the apex of a pyramid that went down to the so-called primitives of the world. Attitudes towards people with physical challenges, you know, dismissed as, you know, retarded or mongoloid or any of these sort of terms that were used. But the point is that it's fascinating. Everything that your great grandparents even believed in, you today as a modern informed person would not only not agree with, you would find them morally reprehensible. And by the same token, the things that you take for granted, that everybody has a right to pursue spiritual beliefs based on their own beliefs, in their own passion, you know, that two women can raise a wonderful family together as long as there's love in the home. I mean, you can go down the list all the way. You know, the fact that, you know, all these things that you believe would have been so strange to your grandparents, right? So the question is, what happened? How did we go from there to here so quickly? You know, within a single generation, women went from the kitchen to the boardroom, people of color from the woodshed to the White House, you know, gay men and women from the closet to the altar. And all of these things came about through political movements. Political movements can only be effective if they're inspired by ideas. And something had to happen that cracked open the 19th century. And ideas that we now see as being completely inconceivable to us, right? And what in fact happened was anthropology. And largely inspired by Franz Boas, the kind of father of American anthropology, he attracted a group of contrarians, some men, but notably women. You know, Elsie Clues Parson, who spoke about feminism in the first decade of the 20th century, who wrote a book calling for marriage to be experimental. I mean, crazy, wild things then. Yeah. People like Zora Neale Hurston, who went off a black American folklorist with a Derringer rifle, a pistol strapped to her thigh as she went through Jim Crow America recording folklore, who later went to Haiti and had the audacity to say that voodoo is not a black magic cult, it's simply the spiritual beliefs of Africa. She was saying that in the 1930s, when black people were being lynched, and when Billie Holiday sang about strange fruit hanging from the tree. Margaret Mead, who not only studied coming of age for women in Samoa, she was herself a poly lover of everybody. I mean, she had three husbands, Gregory Bateson. Her love of her life was Ruth Benedict, the great anthropologist who said the purpose of anthropology is to make the world safe for human differences. And these, under the leadership of Boas, inspiration of Boas, these were people who finally began to say, what is it that makes a culture? What is it that makes values? The whole idea of cultural relativism, the idea that the world into which you're born culturally doesn't exist in some absolute sense, but by definition is a model of reality, the consequence of one set of adaptive choices that your cultural lineage made, however successfully, generations ago. But the other peoples of the world aren't failed attempts at being you. Every culture, by definition, is a unique answer to a fundamental question. What does it mean to be human and alive? And when the peoples of the world answer that question, of course, they do so in the 7,000 voices of humanity. And those languages and those answers become our kind of repertoire for dealing with the challenges we're going to face in the future. Now, the critical thing here, the amazing thing, is that none of those people would live to see that intuition be accepted generally. Certainly none of them live to see it become zeitgeist of our modern era. But if you, for example, think that it's normal for a Jewish girl to fall in love with a Buddhist scholar, if you think that, you know, every religion has a right to be, if you think that all of these things, you're a child of anthropology. But the fantastic thing is that it was always just their idea, their intuition, almost like a hypothesis, and then suddenly something happened. The greatest scientific revelation of our era, the thing that has done more to liberate ourselves from the parochial tyrannies that have haunted us from the day of our birth of consciousness, comes to us from genetics. In our lifetime, geneticists have proven it to be true what Boas intuited to be true. The genetic endowment of humanity is a continuum. Race is a total fiction. We're all cut from the same genetic cloth. We're all children of Africa, those who stayed behind, and those of us who walked out of Africa 65,000 years ago and settled the entire habitable world. But here's the important idea. If we're cut from the same cloth, we share the same genius. There's no hierarchy of progress in culture. That old 19th century idea, you know, that we went from the savage to the barbarian to the civilized to the Strand of London, has been absolutely debunked by modern genetics and shown to be an artifact of the 19th century, no more relevant to our lives today than the notion that clergymen had that the earth was but 6,000 years old. We all are one interconnected humanity. And that means that if we share the same genius, how we express that genius is simply a matter of choice, adaptive imperative. The West has celebrated technological wizardry. Other societies have focused on the complex challenge of unraveling the mystic threads of memory inherent in a myth. But there is no hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And suddenly we then see that all the other voices of humanity are not failed attempts at being us. They're not failed attempts at being modern. They are, as I said, this unique answer. And that means that every culture has something to say. Each deserves to be heard. And the modern world that we live in, we are living in the social realm of the dreams of these early anthropologists. That's why anthropology matters.
Who would not agree with culture and the values of their grandparents,
I'm curious to know, as an anthropologist, how do you look at the cancel culture?
Oh, I think it's hideous. I think it's not political, it's puritanical. It's coming about from a lot of different things. Fear, through the apocalyptic scenarios that are laid upon people all the time, which is a great disservice. We'll never do anything about climate if we're motivated by fear or polemics. Only the promise of a better life will provoke people to change. We're also dealing with a younger generation raised on the iPhone. So from the students that I now have, even in graduate school, as a professor, these are kids who have been told all of their life they don't have to know, they can find out. So they have no sense of history. I have a graduate seminar, it's called Sacred Geography, at UBC, University of British Columbia in Vancouver. It's ranked, I don't know, 37th in the world. It's not a bad, it's a great university. Smart, smart students, wonderful kids. 14 students across the faculties, not one knew the name Mao Zedong. A kid came to me, keen on music and poetry. He had never heard of Bob Dylan. So in other words, I'm not knocking these students, but so the polls in America, for example, say that young students today think that America has never been more racist, which is just historically absurd. Right? And the thing I'm most...
Why is it absurd? Yeah.
Because look at the history of America.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Jim Crow.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, look what was going on in the 1950s, 60s. I mean, you couldn't even eat. I mean, if you don't think that America has made progress on race, you just define history. And here's the thing I find most discouraging about it. It's so nihilistic. We're telling young people that race isn't, that A, it exists, B, you're inherently racist if you're white. And that's I'm not saying that. That's what the movement says, right? And it's so tragic because it's happening in the same era when geneticists, as I mentioned, have actually proven that race is a fiction. It's like I've got this great Polynesian friend. He's a stand-up comic in Hawaii. He does a great routine where he sits on the edge of the stage and he says, race, sunscreen, vitamin D. And that's all race is, right? Physically. Culturally, race is another thing. But biologically, race is all about people in the tropics needing melanin to protect themselves from the sun, and people in higher latitudes having access to vitamin D, which is essential, which comes from the sun, right? That's what it is. Nothing more. No deeper
yeah,
than that.
Some people suffer because of the color of their skin still today, yeah.
Well, that's a cultural construct. What I'm trying to say is that people, what we should be doing is screaming to anyone who will listen, race is a fiction.
Yeah.
And to indulge race for your own kind of personal ideological reasons, and then to turn around and say to young people that no matter what you do, and no matter what we do, we'll never be a colorblind society. In America today, if you say that you endorse what Martin Luther King said when he dreamed that there would come a day when men and women would be judged by the quality of their character, not the color of their skin. If you endorse that statement, you are dismissed as a racist. That's the ideology.
Okay.
Because the ideology of the woke left, it's not even left, by the way, their ideology is that white people are hardwired to be racist. If you're born white, you are racist. Now that is itself racist. I mean, it's silly. But that whole movement, by the way, it's got nothing to do with politics. They never talk about class. They never talk about equity, real equity, economic equity. It's all performative. It's all advertising your virtue. And it's done so much harm. And it's so, so unfortunate. And people are afraid to speak out about it because you can lose your job. In North America right now, all words walk on eggshells.
But you don't.
No, but I mean, I've been fortunate in the sense that, like at the university where I'm retiring, in fact, I have enough kind of status and basically, you know, I've been attacked for silly little things from students, but most of them, I get along with the students, of course, and a little bit, but if you're a junior professor, have their career ruined in a word.
Thank you.
of rapid change and global threat, do you believe our focus on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics is disproportionate?
I mean, all of those things are brilliant tools that has allowed us to do extraordinary things. I mean, think of the revolution in technology we've lived through. I mean, I'm not that old, and I wrote my first two books on a typewriter when cutting and pasting was literally scissors and scotch tape, right? You know, we have this notion that we're going to change the world, or will it change? The world doesn't get changed. The world just goes on. You know, in the Christian tradition, for example, we have this kind of delusion that if we just try hard enough, good will triumph over evil. You know, that Christ's child will triumph over the fallen archangel, yeah, and the devil. As my dad used to say, ain't gonna happen. You know, my father was not a religious man. I never saw the inside of a church in his presence. His spirit was shattered by the war. But he was a very good man, and he believed in good and evil. And he would say to me, son, there's good and evil in the world. Take your side and get on with it. And it was so wise, because what he was saying is that good and evil walk side by side. Always have, always will. And your job in life is to get on the side of good and do what you can in your own precious incarnation, right?
But don't you think some people do you understand, like, some people need to fight a bit more to change the system, that if you only take the side?
No, it doesn't. I'm not saying don't fight.
Okay.
I'm saying don't expect to win. Because if you fight expecting to win and you don't win, you get bitter, and then you get despairing, and then you stop fighting. If you don't expect to win,
but the intention,
you fight as hard at the age of 70, which I am, as I did when I was 20. I never stop. Yeah. And what allows me to keep going is I never expect to win. Sometimes I win. I'll save a mountain. Sometimes I'll lose a mountain. But that, I'm not attached to the, do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's I think, a very positive way of living, you know? I mean, you know, the worst thing we can possibly do is to say to young people, it's all over. It's like the commencement speaker at a graduation at university. Oh, the world's so messed up, it's up to you to fix it. Like hell it is. They didn't mess it up. You know, do you have any children?
Yeah.
Okay, do you really want your children to be raised in a world where they literally believe the world's coming to an end? Yeah, polls in America have the majority of young teenagers believing that climate change is going to eliminate biological life on the planet in the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
That is simply not only untrue, it's ethically abhorrent, right? And it won't provoke the kind of engagement that the climate crisis requires.
But you don't think, like, humans have been a bit crazy with too much industrialization, abuse?
Of course I do. Yeah. Of course I do. I've been speaking about that all my life. That's not the point here. I'm saying fight to protect the Earth, right? You know, one of the challenges in the whole climate crisis thing has been the fact that it's diverted environmental groups all around the world from the real work of protecting home. Mm-hmm. You know, instead, look, you know, it's so easy to fight climate change because there's no accountability. There's no measure of success, basically. I mean, and more importantly, you don't have to confront anything. You don't have to get down to the barricades. I mean, you can march in the streets, but I'm talking about really fighting for your forest. And the only thing that's going to allow us to actually achieve climate resilience is protecting the natural habitats that sequester carbon, right? So, for example, I live in Vancouver. Yeah. Vancouver, with great fanfare, has pledged to go to net zero by 2030. Won't happen, but that's what they're saying. Meanwhile, the province where Vancouver sits every year harvests 65 million cubic meters of timber, devastating, you know, thousands of acres of land, right? So you see these, you know, back to your original question, is science technology going to save the day? I think what will save the day is a change of perspective. And that's what we're going through, and that's a good thing. And that's why I always say, you know, polemics are never persuasive, but storytellers change the world. I mean, if we were lucky enough to see Louis' presentation this morning, and that was a perfect example of the concept of show, don't tell. Nobody wants to be lectured to. I mean, if people would accept fear and being lectured to, the climate thing would have been resolved a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Only hope will motivate people to change behavior and the hope of a better life. And rather than telling people what to do, because they'll never listen, if we can show them another way. And that's why storytellers are so powerful. And that's why, you know, when I'm asked to describe myself, I mean, I guess I've worn many hats. I've been a professor, I've been a filmmaker, I've been, you know, a logger, I've been a hunting guide, I've been, you know, lots of different things in my life, photographer, whatever, writer, you know, but I'm a storyteller. Because
mm-hmm.
I think storytelling is the way you can most effectively shift the human heart. And it's not the mind that we have to change, because we logically, if it was a matter of addressing the mind, well, human reason should have solved the whole thing. You know, it's the heart that we have to address.
What is your achievement you're the proudest of so far?
Well, becoming a father. And this morning I was woken up with the news that I'm a grandfather.
So, oh, congratulations.
So my daughter had her first grandchild this morning.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Baby girl, boy?
A little boy.
Okay.
I think the one thing in terms of sort of these sorts of issues that I can to some extent not take credit for, but you know, one of the reasons that people, linguists, were not speaking about language loss at a time when we all knew that half the languages were disappearing was because of the hold on the linguistic profession that a man called Noam Chomsky had. And Chomsky's argument was basically that language acquisition is so complex and happens in all cultures at the same age that we must be somehow hardwired for language acquisition. It's the old idea that, you know, little children began to speak because mommy said, here's an apple, and they, as a reward, a kind of behavioral thing. He quite properly said that's kind of ridiculous. And all of linguistics, because of his kind of insights, was focused on identifying that structure in the brain that was called the universal grammar. It wasn't a physical structure, it was a kind of a cognitive space based on the hypothesis.
Okay.
And the idea then is that how that space becomes manifest in the world in the language is not that important. What counts is the universal.
Okay.
You know, okay? And so it's a little bit like in biology, using an analogy. If you want to study DNA, you don't need a panda bear. You can use a fruit fly because they're easier to get, right? And you don't really care as a, you know, molecular biologist or, you know, whether or not that DNA, where it comes from, or how it's manifest in the phenotype, which is like the fly or the panda bear. That can be the conservation biologist, but our work is here. Well, it became a little bit like that with languages, where all the linguists were looking for this elusive holy grail of the universal grammar and not paying attention that the expression of that grammar, if that grammar existed, were dying by the day. And it got to the point where you could not get a PhD if you wanted to go and to study a language. And you couldn't, no one was paying attention to dying languages. In fact, it was virtually said, why should we race around and try to understand the grammar or the syntax or the vocabulary, the language, of a language spoken by 100 people? It's sort of a waste of time, right? And so that hold that theoretical position had paralyzed linguistics. And in the late 1990s, I came along knowing really nothing about linguistics. I was a cultural anthropologist. But I found these papers and I was amazed. I didn't understand, why aren't people screaming? If they all agreed that half the languages in the world were disappearing, but no one was doing anything about it, without the exception of a couple of key figures who became important inspirations for me. And I was fortunate to have at that time a bully pulpit at the National Geographic. So I began to scream about language loss because it allowed me to connect audiences with the loss of cultural diversity. You know, you can speak as much as you want in the terms that I spoke with you a few minutes ago about every culture is an expression thing. But if you say to an audience, how would you feel to be enveloped in silence, to have no ability to pass on your native language to your children or to understand the language of your ancestors? Well, that's the fate of somebody every 2 weeks on earth, because every 2 weeks some elder in some culture passes away and carries the last syllables of an ancient tongue into the grave. That just the audiences would gasp at that, right? They could understand that. That's the nature of good storytelling, if you will. So I was sort of interested as a way of talking about cultural diversity. But in doing so, I was able to kind of cry out about it. And at that time, and this was not my doing, there was a whole kind of movement growing in the new generation of linguists, sort of saying, what if the emperor has no clothes? And it suddenly was dawning. And so I wrote a couple of books and made a bunch of films. And I can't lay credit, but right after that, or as part of that, suddenly it shifted. And there was like, in the first 10 years of the century, there were suddenly dozens of books coming out, you know, from fantastic linguists, and revitalization programs being set up all around the world, and people realizing that this was a real serious crisis for the human patrimony. So I think that in terms of my academic career, I think that's one thing I would say I was proud of. And also just, you know, as a communicator, you know, I've written 23 books, I've made 40 films, I've done at least 2,000 large public presentations. You know, eventually some of that gets into the zeitgeist of the society, one hopes, but you don't know. But certainly being a spokesperson for that, just for the obvious, something that turned me on so when I was so young. You know, it's interesting. You're French, aren't you?
Yes.
Okay, well, you know, I grew up in Quebec.
Yes.
During the time of the two solitudes, when the French and English didn't speak to each other. And I was in a little community that was an Anglophone suburb of Montreal, plunk like a carbuncle in the back of a very old Francophone community called Pointe-Claire. And there was a boulevard, Jacques-Cartier Boulevard, which literally divided the two, right?
Okay.
And don't forget, we had martial law, tanks in the streets, decorative terrorist bombings. It was a tough time in Montreal, in Canada. And my mom, when I was five, would send me to a little corner store on Cartier Boulevard, where a beautiful old Francophone couple had a little épicerie, you know. And I'd get my mom's cigarettes or milk, and I'd sit on their bench on their porch, and I'd look across that boulevard, and I'd think, at the age of five, six, wow, right across that road's another language, another religion, another way of being. Why am I not allowed to cross this road? And of course, it wasn't my parents who were very kind and beloved in the village, but my society was saying, you know. And I think I've been crossing that road ever since.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. Do you think that's linked to your passion for crossing the roads now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, also, that was a very kind of pretty boring suburb. And I learned very early on that if I was not going to get stuck in that kind of bourgeois way of thinking, living, I better get out. And so I learned very early to have only one word in my vocabulary, and that was yes, and to jump off cliffs, you know. And one thing I discovered in life is that no one wants you to change, ever. Mm. And you have to follow your inner compass, and you have to understand that creativity is not the motivation of action, it's a consequence of action. If you don't do something, you can't create. People aren't born creative, which is a bourgeois fantasy, right? No, you have to make yourself creative. And so given my background, anyone who knows that background but my family would say it's simply astonishing that I've written 23 books and made these films, and, you know. But a lot of that was just, you know, it's like the first man to climb Mount Everest for the Americans, Jim Whittaker, who became a friend of mine. And Jim used to say, if you're not living on the edge when you're young, you're taking up too much space. You know, so I everything for me in life was serendipity. You know, I went to Harvard because I used to fight forest fires. We may have discussed that in previous things, so let's not go there. But no, I mean, it's that idea of saying yes, you know, and putting yourself in the way of opportunities where there's no choice but success. And then, of course, you find yourself capable, everybody knows that, capable of doing things that would have been beyond you a month before. So I think my problem at the age of 70 is stopping doing that. You know, so much of my life has been forged by reacting to opportunities, jumping off that cliff, discovering that you land on a feather bed, not rocks. How do you stop that process so that you can learn in your last years not to do, but to be, you know, like Epicurus, you know, he talked about the glorious years before decrepitude and after you step off the stage. And the notion of retirement is kind of a bizarre notion. I mean, do you know why we retire at 65?
Because, to let the other
work? No, because Bismarck in the 19th century, trying to quell labor unrest in Kaiser's Germany, picked an age, they wanted to start a kind of social security program, an incipient program, but they didn't want to pay any of the workers anything. So they picked an age where statistically almost everybody would be dead. And that's why we retired 65, when most of us are now going to live to 90.
Wow.
Right?
Okay. Yeah.
And so retirement in the West is kind of a crazy idea. What real retirement is not when you stop being active, it's when you realize you've had your moment. You know, and it's time to move off the stage to let the next generation move on. Not in a discouraged way, but just in a grateful way. Because that's all we have. You know, this is why I get back to this idea, don't expect to win. It's so, think about how kind of self-absorbed and even arrogant it is to think that you're going to make a difference in this world. I mean, we dream that, maybe.
True. But very few people do, yeah.
But we all make a difference by definition. But we also just have a moment in time, we do our best, and then, hey, it's your turn. You know, I have no problem with that.
Talking about the next generation, so your dad gave you a beautiful advice. And what is, if your grandson in a few years is asking you with all your experience, can you give me one advice? What will you tell him?
Pessimism is an indulgence. Despair and insult to the imagination. Orthodoxy is the enemy of invention. Do what needs to be done and then ask whether it was possible or permissible. And above all, be patient. Don't listen to people around you. Follow your inner compass and give your destiny time to find you.
Quick question. What's your favorite tool to actively transform our society, our planet, or ourselves?
A tool, or do you mean a literal tool?
Yeah, or idea, or a concept.
Love.
Thank you, Wade Davis.
My pleasure.
Thank you for being there for a second podcast together. I enjoyed
it. My language will always fun with you.
Thank you so much.
God bless.
Thank you for joining us on this insightful journey with Wade Davis in his second interview for the Harvest Series podcast. I've personally found immense joy in unraveling the significance of anthropology in a world that often prioritizes science and technology. Wade's wealth of experience and wisdom make it a genuine honor to hear his perspectives on modern life. If you resonated with our conversation, we'd greatly appreciate your support. Kindly consider leaving us a positive review and connecting with us on Instagram at Harvest Series. You can also catch the visual experience of our podcast on youtube.com/Harvest Series. Our next episode features Howard Covington, a distinguished British lawyer who found himself advising the Chinese government on going greener. His story is nothing short of fascinating, and I can't wait to share it with you. Until next time, stay curious and keep harvesting knowledge.